Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Mountaineer Conrad Anker. Right now, I would like to welcome Elizabeth Peterson. She's the director of the New Mexico Brain Injury Advisory Council, and Vince Bell, who is a musician who will be doing a benefit performance for the Brain Injury Advisory Council on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, October 28th, called One Man's Music, a Monologue with Song, at the New Mexico Museum of Fine Arts in Santa Fe at the St. Francis Auditorium. That's at 6:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So brain injuries are an area of medicine, an area of injury that people who don't have it or whose families haven't been affected by it often have not the slightest clue about. What are the causes of brain injuries?
Well, first of all, we think about brain injury as the silent epidemic. It affects about one in every 10 families. We hear a lot about traumatic brain injuries because of the war. We hear about blast injuries. But in the state of New Mexico, interestingly, motor vehicle crashes are the second leading cause of death for brain injuries. Suicide by firearm is the leading cause of brain injury and death in the state of New Mexico.
So people who commit suicide don't survive, but then these many people who do survive, whatever the traumas are, and some of them are war, car crash, assault.
Mm-hmm. Falls. I mean, you know, our elderly population, that's the leading cause of death and disability for our elderly population. They slip and fall in their home. Children, their leading cause of death, unfortunately, in the state of New Mexico, by brain injury is because they're shaken and abused as children.
There's a wonderful movie that you helped to put together called Every 21 Seconds. That's how often somebody gets a brain injury in this country. And there is a just heart-wrenching story of a little girl who was shaken by somebody who had no idea that he was doing the baby harm, presumably. And the child is basically totally disabled for life.
Yeah, Chloe was shaken as an infant by a caregiver, and what we know is typically it takes one moment in time of frustration, and the baby might be crying, and just in order to stop the crying, the baby's shaken and lives a life of disability as a result.
And this child was quadriplegic. Mm-hmm. With cerebral palsy acquired from the brain injury, was going blind, was going deaf.
Mm-hmm. She's been adopted by an incredible family in Albuquerque. Her adoptive mom is the chair of the Brain Injury Advisory Council, and Chloe lives with them and is in the late stages of her life at the age of 11.
So another cause of brain injury is allergic reaction or other kinds of medical situations.
Yeah, for example, we call them acquired brain injuries, but folks that have strokes or lack of oxygen to the brain, the federal government really looks at traumatic brain injury and gets statistics and data based on that. New Mexico, we're really trying to look at both the citizens who have acquired as well as traumatic brain injuries. Because a brain injury is a brain injury. Vince can talk about that, you know. The symptoms are very similar. You get a brain injury differently through an acquired injury, but it's still living with brain injury.
Vince, you were a musician and songwriter, and you got hit by a drunken driver at a certain point in your life, and then had to basically start all over. What was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was 10 years worth of work, relearning how to walk, talk, play the guitar. I'm one of the only fellows I know in music that's had to learn how to play the instrument he plays twice. So it was a pain, and it was very long in regaining those abilities. I was fortunately able to do this, though, so I worked very hard, and now very much enjoy the being as normal as most everybody with this brain injury still, you know, affecting me. Like I mentioned earlier to you, I can be cute in front of 1,000 people and get the encore, but I can never wake up and not be brain injured.
How does it show up in your daily life?
I'm extremely forgetful, this and that. Very hard to hold on to short-term memories. So I can remember your phone number because I memorized it, but I can't remember your name because I didn't meet you lately.
Right.
So it's tenuous. It's tough. There's balance problems. There's deadness to your skins and parts of your body and all kinds of things. But after 10, 15 years of working with it, you become as good as working that program as you did your initial. So,
one of the things that came out in this film, Every 21 Seconds, which I highly recommend. We can talk about how people can get a copy of this DVD and see it, because it's a beautifully made film. But one of the things that was really shocking was that some studies were done that showed that a very high majority of prisoners in certain prisons who were there for, you know, major serious crimes were brain injured before they ever got involved in any crime at all.
Yeah, both national and international statistics tell us that about 80 to 82% of our prison populations have brain injuries, whether they go in with them or get them while they're in there. What we also know is the majority of those people go back into society and become our next-door neighbors and our community members. And prisons don't necessarily provide the right environment to live with a brain injury. It's a huge problem, certainly in our state, but throughout the country and world.
And it really speaks to this whole problem of the cycle of violence, because, of course, people get brain injured through violence, whether it be child abuse, violent assault, or any of the other kinds of things that involve falling down and hitting your head when you live in a rough environment.
Exactly. And I think domestic violence, you know, it's staggering how many folks that are victims of domestic violence have brain injuries. What we know is a lot of people don't self-report, may go to the emergency room or doctor and complain of other issues, and the brain injury is never diagnosed. It's never identified. That's certainly what we're finding with our troops that are returning from Iraq and who have blast injuries.
This brain injury stuff is the Wild West of medicine these days. Nobody knows how to treat it, diagnose it, see it. It's hard for me to tell people what's going on behind the broken little windows of my eyes. It's hard because it's very complex, that brain thing. And you start messing with it, and you make troubles and problems that people can't turn into an industry. I mean, you can fix your cancer people these days and others, but the medical profession really draws a blank when it comes to treating and dealing with the brain injury. It's a tough time and for all of us that are brain injured, and we'll have to be patient because these things take forever. Medical advances and this and that's that will turn our grief into making us okay. So.
Yeah, I think we call brain injury the silent epidemic because you can't see it. You know, you see somebody walking down the street using crutches. They might have broken their leg.
Right.
There's an identifiable course of treatment. And with brain injury, sometimes you can't see it. You might see symptoms, but you necessarily can't see the injury. So they often get overlooked.
And there's so many personality changes that come with a brain injury. So, for example, one of the people in this wonderful film was injured, he was brain injured, and he lost his ability to control his impulses and ended up in jail. Mm-hmm. And so from the outside, we have judgment and say, well, he should have controlled his impulses, and he couldn't because he had an undiagnosed brain injury.
Yeah, and that happens a lot. Those are the symptoms that people see. For example, our veterans that are returning from Iraq with blast injuries, we're also now wondering, well, is it post-traumatic stress disorder? Is it or a traumatic brain injury? It could be both. Symptoms look almost identical. The treatments are different. So, yeah, it's very difficult to identify if you look at someone. And even medical diagnoses, you know, with MRIs, don't always pick up what a brain injury is.
And, of course, brain science is really in its infancy or toddlerhood at best, so yep. There's a lot that people don't have the slightest idea about.
Not at all. In fact, it's so Wild West that they can't turn it into an industry. So they can't get anybody to do it for any length of time to become proficient. Like they say, when you're sick and you go to the hospital, if they've done the procedure on you 1,000 times in the last while, good. They know what they're doing. If they don't, you know, have any idea what they're doing, they're like you and me. They don't know.
Well, and I think the Iraq War and the recent conflicts have really increased our the emphasis on brain injury. And I think the Department of Defense and others are really looking at brain injury in a very different way. And there's a lot of research going on. But at this point, there is no cure for brain injury. I always say the only cure is prevention.
And when we talk about prevention, there are things like don't drive drunk, don't let anybody else you know drive drunk, drive defensively, and wear a helmet when you're on a two-wheeled vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the simple things, you know. We a few years ago, passed the most comprehensive children's helmet law in the country. And now we've got to get the word out. We've got this law, and it's hard to enforce, and people don't know about it. So simple things, like just put helmets on your kids when they're riding their bike.
That's funny, because we don't have an adult motorcycle helmet law.
No, and I think it would be very difficult to pass. It took us 5 years to have the Children's Helmet Safety Act passed. So, yeah, I'd love to see helmets on people's heads of all ages.
The symptoms of brain injuries are multivarious personality changes and all sorts of cognitive losses. Tell us some of the things that people go through.
Well, on the documentary, Every 21 Seconds, Barbara tells the wonderful story of tripping and falling in front of her apartment building, and she didn't realize that she hit her head as hard as she did. And then she began not being able to sleep well. She couldn't balance her checkbook. She couldn't make a sandwich. She became so fatigued that just getting up took all of her energy. I mean, those are very varied symptoms, but it can be loss of vision, increased sense of a heightened sense of smell, as Vince talked about, short-term memory loss, long-term memory loss,
yep.
Balance issues. I mean, the list goes on and on. The brain does everything for our body. So when we get it, when we have some sort of assault to the brain, it can affect almost everything we do.
We brain injured are like border collies, no two alike. So everybody's got different problems. When I go to a support group, try to lend a hand, hang out, be like somebody else, and lend a hand, and there's not a person in that room that's like me. They all have different problems. And so you can only say what you did to maybe rehabilitate yourself and hope that it resonates with someone so that they'll go back home and work on their problems with the same diligence.
Yeah. I once had a conversation with 3 friends, all of whom had brain problems, 2 of them due to illnesses and 1 of them due to a traumatic event. And they all were talking about how they were incapable of making a list of 10 things and going and doing the 10 things on the list. And to somebody who makes lists of 10 things all the time and does them all, it's almost incomprehensible. But to see the 3 people there saying, oh yeah, I'm exactly the same way, was really humbling.
I was renovating a house years ago, and I had a construction accident and hit my head, had a concussion, developed post-concussion syndrome. And I'm one of those people, that great list maker, multitasker. And while I was maybe 2 months after the concussion, I went into the grocery store with a list to get some green vegetables for dinner, and I couldn't make the decision of which green vegetable to buy because there were too many. I left in tears, and then when I got into the parking lot, I couldn't find my car because I forgot where I parked it. I don't have those symptoms anymore, but it was eye-opening. It was devastating in that time period to just, you know, not be able to do a simple thing like picking out broccoli.
Yeah. When you're brain injured, that's the challenge. It's to, like, figure that out so that next time you have a bout with broccoli, you win.
Well, and I think it is also really important to talk about the fact that for people who have never had brain injuries, but just who have either different abilities or just losses due to aging or whatever, some of those injuries are really a difference of scale, but not of kind, from what a lot of regular people walking around have. Short-term memory loss, for example, affects
you see the nightmare.
How many people see, over 40?
You see the nightmare. You see, there's not, you can't really put a handle on it. You can't even define it. Is it this? Is it that? Is it this or that? Hey, the guy can't use his head right, you know? The girl can't do the thing she wants to do. That's brain injury, and that is so nebulous and so impossible to translate. That's the lot we face these days. That's a lot about what my play will highlight next Wednesday at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and.
Vince Bell's play, One Man's Music, A Monologue with Song, that's at 6:30 this coming Wednesday,
right,
October 28th at the St. Francis Auditorium. Yeah. Vince Bell is here with Elizabeth Peterson, director of the New Mexico Brain Injury Advisory Council.
Yeah, and I want to thank my buddies, Tim and Evelyn Taylor, the Banded Geckos, and Scott Catanasso for helping me finish up the night with the songwriter in the round.
So, what kinds of advances in brain sciences have been promising for actually healing traumatic brain injuries?
Yeah, I recently read an article. They were looking at stem cell advancement. They're looking at the sooner somebody gets treatment, there's this what's called the golden hour, and if you can get the right treatment at the right time, that really helps in somebody's diagnosis and recovery.
Right, and it's really important to make the point as well. There's no healing from this brain injury stuff. This is adapting. Like Carl Sagan said, Mr. Billions and Billions, adapt or perish. That is the lot for the brain injured person. So you can't do something away. You've always done it. Well, learn how to do it another way. And that's the victory in brain injury, is being able to teach another synaptic connection what to do, because the other one is busted.
Yeah, and I think the brain is, it is kind of the last frontier, and we're amazed constantly by the elasticity and how the brain can adapt and how people with brain injury can live a really great quality of life. Their life might be different after the brain injury, but there's also, there are services in the state of New Mexico and certainly around the country. People can live a really good life still with brain injury.
Now, some people do come back after a year or after a certain amount of time.
Absolutely. I mean, Vince is a great example of someone who had a significant brain injury, and look at him now.
Yep.
What kinds of services are available and not available to people who have brain injuries? It seems like the kind of thing where insurance companies, especially as they are today, pre-health insurance reform, would probably not be paying for a lot of necessary things.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the state. I'd love to see our state insurance companies pay for post-acute rehab. That's a critical time when, you know, folks have gone through the initial rehab phase, but they're not quite ready to go home. But, you know, we're lucky in our state. We have a short-term service fund for folks with traumatic brain injuries. Doesn't do everything for everyone, but it's easy to get into, and I consider it kind of the portal to other services in the state. And then we have long-term services for folks that qualify for Medicaid. So they have to be significantly impaired by their brain injury and financially eligible. But we're lucky that we have that, and it's a fairly flexible program to help people live in the community, not in nursing homes, but in the community.
Are there exercises that people can do that are the equivalent of what you might do in terms of physical therapy after a physical accident?
Yeah, there are, and I bet Vince has some great stories
like
about that.
We're all so different that those applications are individual. Brain injury is really a very singular, very personal problem. Like I said, it's hard for me to relate to you just how funny it is because I can't show you. I can't show you a broken part or something like that that's easy. Just go, oh, well, it's broke. Well, can't do that with brain injury. Just got to kind of...
But, I mean, did you, for example, did playing the guitar do...
Music was a great discipline for me to have been able to go back to. Because it forced me to relearn how to count to four, as the musician says. It forced me to relearn how to play the chords and sing the words at the right time and all that. So,
yeah, and that was a great form of cognitive rehab for
you. You bet.
Yeah, and I'm sure the manual dexterity of playing the guitar would be very much like occupational therapy. You know, and I think that Vince's passion really helped his
yes.
Road to recovery and living with brain injury as he is now, because he had something that really pushed him.
Me.
Yeah, and I think that's really important.
It's like a crusade.
Yeah, and some people ride horses, some people do, you know, all sorts of things. But if you lead a passionate life before brain injury, you know, I think that drives people to really get back and try to live a quality life.
This film, Every 21 Seconds, a wonderful DVD, about an hour long. Tell us about the making of this film and how people can get a copy of it.
The film was made 4 years ago, and I found a filmmaker who was living in Santa Fe at the time named Laura Napier, and she also lives with a brain injury. So we decided that we needed to tell the stories of people in New Mexico living with brain injuries so that other people could identify with them. Although it's a very personal experience, what we found, families and individuals watch this and realize that they're not alone. So Laura is one of 8 people that told their stories of living with brain injury. If people want a copy, they can call me or email me. The Brain Injury Association of New Mexico also has copies of it. So the Brain Injury Association, who we're doing this benefit for actually, does a lot of information and referral work throughout the state. So their toll-free number is 888-292-7415. And my phone number, direct line at work, is 476-7328. People can call and ask me questions and request a copy of the DVD. It's complimentary. We want to get it in the hands of people that need it.
And we also want to mention that people who have brain injuries can get into this event free. They have to call in advance and leave a message with Elizabeth at 476-7382, 476-7382, and just mention how many tickets you need, and they will be there at the door for you. Elizabeth Peterson is the director of the New Mexico Brain Injury Advisory Council, which can also be found on the web, and they have a terrific website, nmbiac.com. And Vince Bell is a musician, and once again, his performance is this Wednesday, October 28th, One Man's Music, a Monologue with Song, at the St. Francis Auditorium at 6:30. That's in the New Mexico Museum of Art.
With my buddies Tim and Evelyn Taylor, the Banded Geckos, and Scott Catanasso.
Fabulous. Thank you both so much for being here. And we're going to go out with some music from Vince Bell from his disc, One Man's Music. And tell us, you've got a song called Sun and Moon and Stars, and Lyle Lovett is recording that on his new disc.
It was released on October 20th, and it's a good sounding cut.
From him and from you.
From him and from me.
Thanks again for being here.
Easy.
Thanks so much.
The sun and moon and stars make the wind blow. It took me 20 years to understand, but lost to me is how the lives of friends go, like autumn leaves in Oklahoma wind. It made me strong be on my own. Never did me no harm to live all alone. But now and then, in the color of the evening, in a bar room with a fan turning, I come to miss a few.
I'm very happy now to welcome, joining us by telephone, mountaineer Conrad Anker. He will be in Santa Fe tomorrow night in a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians in an event sponsored by the North Face and Sangre de Cristo. It's called Mount Meru, the Center of the Universe, Teamwork and Tenacity in the Himalaya. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary. How are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you on the show. This is the kind of climbing you do, the kind of mountaineering work you do is probably terrifying to even contemplate for most people. You kind of do almost death-defying mountain trips, but tend to survive. Tell us how you got into this whole world of mountain climbing.
I was introduced to the mountains by my parents at a young age in Central California and grew up in the Sierras. And I went from climbing up peaks that had a pretty straightforward approach to them to bigger and more ambitious things, probably like El Capitan. And that was my sort of the next level where I went to was climbing on El Capitan. And that was really the start of it. And then combining winter camping skills with the type of climbing you would find on El Capitan, that's what Himalayan big wall climbing is all about.
So Himalayan big wall climbing, tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, imagine your worst day of skiing, which is snowing and it's frigid and blowing sideways, but you don't have a ski lift, and you've got the equipment that you need to survive, your tent, your sleeping bag, your stove, your food. And then toss in with that rock climbing of the highest grade, and then on top of that, high altitude. So we're doing all of these at 20,000 feet, which is extreme altitude. So it's sort of a combination of different skills and layering one level of difficulty onto the next each time you progress.
You have to obviously train for a long time and have a lot of different kinds of experiences before you get to a level where you can do that hardest kind of climbing. And I imagine you also don't do it alone. How do you work with other people to accomplish that kind of climbing?
The first step is finding a good team to climb with, and on this team we were with Jimmy Chin and Renan Ozturk. And there's plenty of skilled climbers around, but what you're really looking for is someone that you get along with and that can pick up when you're feeling out of it and has skills that will support you. So there's a combination of them. And then over that is the ability to get along and be friends.
what is the actual, tell, how do I say this? Describe some of the kinds of techniques that you use to do some of those difficult climbs. Like, what is the actual technology for getting up these extremely difficult mountains?
The rope is primarily your safety net, and as you go up, you put pieces of protection in, and they're little bits of aluminum and steel that are about the size of cracks, which are weaknesses, and you put them in there, and they kind of stop in there. They set into a constriction. You use a carabiner. You clip your rope through there. That's the very basic part of it. And then belaying is the act of securing the rope from below. So that's your safety network that we use as climbers. And you sort of centipede one pitch after another going up the mountain. And that's the climbing technique. On this climb, which we'll be sharing tomorrow night about Meru, we're sleeping in portal edges, which are rectangular cliff tents that you sit on the side of the mountain with, and we got stuck in a 5-day storm up there, and that was kind of the sort of getting us excited about it, and the culmination of all these different techniques.
Sleeping in the cold on the side of a mountain seems really scary and uncomfortable. What is it actually like?
Unless you happen to like it. If you happen to like it, then you're living large. So. And I happen to like it. I think it's a fun thing to do. So to me, it's just like being a kid and I'm playing fort and I'm going back to what it was like when I was a young man. So, but on this instance, it would be we were always constantly battling cold temperatures and conditions that were the wind was blowing. And then having to stay in there, we really didn't have enough food to get through in a great level of comfort.
Well, that's another big question, is what kind of food you eat on a climb like that, that is lightweight enough to carry, that is nourishing enough to eat, and that you can really digest at high altitudes?
Yeah, it's a challenge. We eat oatmeal and supplement that with soy protein in the morning, and then we'll have an energy bar or two during the day, and then in the evening we would have dehydrated beans with olive oil and a little bit of cheese. So, but we went up with 8 days of food, and we spent 19 days on the route. And even a second grader can do the math on that. So we ran out of food. It was pretty grim.
What did you do?
Well, we rationed food, and you just realize that the human body is pretty strong. We can do with a lot less calories than what we think we need, and then you can sort of go on willpower, and you start metabolizing your body and your organs. It's not a good thing to do, but every once in a while, it probably builds character.
Now, Mount Meru, the center of the universe, teamwork and tenacity in the Himalaya, that's the title of the presentation that you're going to be giving along with photographer Jimmy Chin, whom we'll talk about in a second. Why the center of the universe?
For the Hindu religion, the Garhwal is the source of the Gangotri and the river Ganges. So, and the Ganges River is the most holy river for the Hindu religion. And the peaks that are surround the glacier where this starts from are all of special religious significance. And Meru is behind Shivling, which is the abode of Lord Shiva, and it's known as the center of the universe. So it's in deference to their religion, not in any Jules Verne type thing or some sort of Western ego that, oh, we were so cool that we could go to the center of the universe. It was the name, Meru means center of the universe for in the Hindu religion.
Right. So do people in this area, in the Himalaya, do they climb mountains, or is it only sort of crazy nuts from the West like us?
There are mountain climbers from India. The mountain climbing for your average person is you have to have a fair amount of resources, and that includes time to practice the craft and do it. And in the West, we have that because of our highly materialistic, consumeristic society. So many of the people that are living in a subsistence existence, mountain climbing is the last thing they'd ever want to do. That being said, the growing middle class in India, there are a lot of really keen climbers. And we ran into expeditions from Mumbai, from Delhi, that were up there, and they were climbing. And it was great to interact with them. But the local villagers, they're not climbers.
How do they respond to the expeditions of people who come in? They're not climbers themselves. What do they think of you?
The villagers that are lower elevation, they're fine with it. It's a source of income. We try to employ as many people as we can, and there's the multiplier effect of the money that we bring into their communities. And then at the base camp, it's a holy place, and there's a lot of sadhus and matajis, which are holy people, and they're kind of just like a New Yorker cartoon sitting on the side of the mountain and answering the questions of the seekers. And for these holy people climbing in the mountains, they think it's pretty cool. They're like, you guys are on your own spiritual quest too, and we can relate to it. And what's it like when you go up there, and did you see things that we have in our literature about these mountains? Are they there? So they're really they're supportive of it, and we're not breaking any rules about, oh, it's a sacred mountain, or please don't climb there.
Did you ever ask them any big questions?
Well, the sadhus,
yeah,
probably so. I mean, I guess the one to take away from it is that enlightenment is not found on a full belly or a soft bed. So for the sadhus that live up there in a cave at 14,000 feet on flour and tea and praying all day long and basically living in a pretty minimal existence, for them, it's they're sort of the same way to do that. So, but they're also very aware. We would have conversations with the people up there about climate change, about receding glaciers, and sort of looking at things in a geologic cosmic time frame.
We're talking to mountaineer Conrad Anker. So there really is kind of a similarity in their quest and yours. I mean, how would you describe your quest? It seems like more than just, I mean, I don't know if you would call it a spiritual quest or whatever, but it seems like something comes from a very deep place in you.
We're motivated by something I have yet to pin down after 34 years of climbing, so it's kind of still a mystery, but I guess it's this, humans have always had this drive to explore and to find out what the world is about, and that's why we're the dominant species on this planet, and we've been able to harness our intellect and create machines and little things that make life better, to understand agriculture and to domesticate animals, and we're really, I mean, because of that, humans, we have too many of us on this planet, so there's that elemental part of it, and I think that as alpinists and mountaineers and what we're doing is that this drive for knowledge, this looking to the unknown, and this quest to seek out risk and to pit yourself against it and to bring it back and tell a story is as timeless as humans are, and that in a very odd, small, humble way, we're keeping this risk, keeping the risk gene alive and healthy in our culture.
There's also risks that don't pan out very well. You were on a climb with your dear friend Alex Lowe, and in an avalanche, he lost his life and you survived.
That was, yes, 10 years ago. And climbing is very dangerous. It's more so than motor racing or many of the other high-risk sports. And so it's one is very aware of that. And to practice the sport of high-altitude climbing in the Himalaya, one needs to come to terms with death, to make peace with it, and to realize that how fragile and how fleeting life really is, and that it's important to live it to its fullest each day.
For someone who climbs glaciers, their disappearance or their shrinking because of climate change has a whole other dimension than it does even for the rest of us.
Yeah, very accurate observation, Mary. And it's one of these things where the the changing of our Earth's atmosphere, the fact that CO2 levels have gone up from 250 parts per million when we founded our nation to about 380 parts per million, and the trapping of greenhouse gases, and the anthropogenic alteration of the Earth's climate, it's happening, and we're a result of it because coal-fired electrical plants, driving automobiles, the life that we live, and I'm as guilty as the next person. And glaciers are the most obvious physical manifestation of a warmer planet. And you can't say, well, the glaciers, they're doing fine. I mean, they're not. And something as simple as photographs illustrate how much the glaciers are shrinking and receding. So there's a lot of science out there that is letting us know that we are changing the state of our planet, and that we need to be thinking about how we're going to leave the Earth for future generations.
You work with photographer Jimmy Chin, who will also be at this presentation tomorrow night, Mount Meru, the Center of the Universe, Teamwork and Tenacity in the Himalaya. And by the way, that's there's a reception at 6 o'clock and the presentation at 7 o'clock at the Armory for the Arts here in Santa Fe. Jimmy is not only a mountaineer, but a photographer. That adds yet another dimension of both beauty and, I would imagine, risk to the whole endeavor of mountain climbing.
Yeah, and Jimmy is one of the world's best outdoor photographers. He's a great climber and skier, and is by just alone that. And then he's able to take the camera up there and take his skills and use them to share the story of being in the mountains with more than just a few people.
His photography is stunning, and I guess people will get a chance to see it at this event. How do you work with him? How do you, as a climber, assist in the whole endeavor of photography?
Well, in this instance, sort of the teamwork of getting the equipment up there and sharing the load that we have to carry, and then being a subject for his photographs, being there with in them. So that's pretty key.
Now, you were on the trek to find the first man who climbed Mount Everest. Is that correct?
Yeah. In 1999, on the 1st of May, I discovered the frozen and well-preserved body of George Lee Mallory, who had disappeared 75 years earlier in 1924 on the north side of Mount Everest. And it was a great story, whether or not they could have made it up to the summit. And it's a very wonderful story. There's a film that we've been working on titled The Wildest Dream that's due out early next year that's about that. So there's more information if you're interested. You can also look me up online, and I have a book I've written about it. So it's a pretty fascinating story.
I mean, it's unbelievable. How did you actually find the body, the man himself?
There were a little bit of a clue was shared with Western climbers in 1975. A Chinese expedition came across an English dead, and that's how they described it. And we knew that there was two fatalities pre-Second World War on Mount Everest, and those were George Mallory and Sandy Irvin. So with that information, we knew that it was one of those two climbers that had disappeared.
One of the things that I think is most important about being a successful climber is knowing when it's time to turn around, even if you haven't hit the summit yet. How do you make that judgment?
Well, part of it is intuitive. You know that, okay, the situation isn't favorable anymore. We don't have enough reserves to make it back safe and sound, and that you play your cards accordingly. And the main thing is you don't want to get into a situation where you have a small accident that would then sort of catapult into something larger and more challenging.
In Mount Meru, was that a decision you had to make?
Yeah, we didn't make it to the top. We got to within probably two or three pitches, and we just realized that it wasn't in the cards, so we had to turn back. And that's part of the story that we will share with your listeners tomorrow. And it'd be great to say, oh, here it is, a heroic tale, make it to the top of the mountains. But you learn more from your mistakes, and that's we all know that. And I learned quite a bit on this trip about what I could do and how our team functioned and a lot of other things like that. So it was pretty important to have that all together.
Conrad Anker is a mountaineer, and once again, he and mountaineer and photographer Jimmy Chin will be at the Armory for the Arts tomorrow night, Tuesday, October 27th. There is a VIP reception at 6 o'clock, which you can buy tickets for from Wild Earth Guardians, and then a presentation for the general public at 7 o'clock. And for more information, people can go ahead and give Wild Earth Guardians a call. Conrad Anker, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Mary, thank you very much, and big shout out to the folks at NPR. You guys rock.
Thank you so much. And by the way, the presentation is called Mount Meru, Center of the Universe, Teamwork and Tenacity in the Himalaya. Conrad Anker's website is Conrad Anker, that's A-N-K-E-R, conradanker.com. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Cabby for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the colors of jazz.
Thank you.